This is Science Friday. I'm Sci-Fi producer Kathleen Davis, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll talk to the author of a new book about history and climate change. But first, there's still a lot to be learned about the physics of our universe. And one of the most perplexing ideas is an observation made around a decade ago that the universe seems to be expanding faster than it should be. Now, 2 years of James Webb Space Telescope data back up that finding. Joining me now to talk about that and other topics from the week in science news is Casey Crownhart, climate and technology reporter at MIT Technology Review. Welcome back to Science Friday, Casey.
Thanks so much. Great to be here as always.
Great to have you. So explain this story to me. The universe is expanding too fast. What does that mean?
I know this one, as most space stories do, broke my brain a little bit. Basically, there are a couple of different ways that we can kind of measure or observe how fast the universe is expanding. One of them is by kind of looking back at the earliest light from just after the Big Bang, basically, and then doing calculations based on our understanding of like how the cosmos works. Another way is to take space telescope data, look at things that are very far away, stars, supernovas, and you can tell how far away they are and how fast they look to be moving. The problem is that those two ways of observing and measuring the expansion of the universe don't line up. And we've, like you said, we've known that since the Hubble Space Telescope, but now the James Webb Space Telescope really confirmed that. So now we can't really blame Hubble anymore and think that it's just some like instrument error. It looks to be a real problem.
So when we say too fast, we're talking about in the context of our own understanding of the universe, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's, and I mean that we're talking about like huge time scales, huge length scales. So it's significant. It's like about 8% faster, I think, than what it quote unquote should be, but it's significant.
So if we have confirmation that it wasn't just some telescope error, where does that leave physicists?
Yes, with a lot of questions to answer.
Right.
So there are definitely theories about where this might be coming from. Some of the leading ones are that dark matter or dark energy have something to do with this. These are things that we know exist in the universe, but are sort of invisible to us. We just kind of infer them based on how they affect regular matter and energy. So that is kind of a leading theory, but there's a lot of research to be done still, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to keep us on the head-scratching topics for just a little bit longer. Quantum computing. Google made an announcement this week about quantum computing. Tell me about this.
Yes, definitely in the same category of brain-breaking. So Google announced this week that it has a new quantum computing chip called Willow. And there are two really interesting things about this new chip. One is that it's capable of performing a computing challenge in less than 5 minutes. Whereas today's the world's fastest supercomputers would take longer than the age of the universe to do the same kind of work. The other thing that's really interesting about this is that they were able to do error correction in a really interesting way. So one of the big problems that's keeping quantum computers from being useful is that the universe is a really noisy place, and things like the movement of electrons and like atomic effects can introduce errors into quantum computing. So the other interesting thing about this Google chip announcement is that they showed that as they built bigger computers or bigger quantum chips, they were able to correct errors.
So do we have any idea if this is something that Google's going to save for themselves and do quantum googly things, or are they maybe planning to sell this technology to other people?
That's a great question. They didn't say in their blog about this what exactly the plans are. But I mean, to be fair, we're still pretty far from this being useful. I mentioned that this is, you know, better at correcting errors than most quantum computers are, but it's still way, way, way off from doing things like solving algorithms or doing good simulations of chemistry, which are some things that quantum computers might eventually be used for. So we've still got a long way to go with the research here.
Okay, so let's move on to some more concrete electronics. You have a story for us from this week about improving the electronics of prosthetic devices, right?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting story in Wired this week. Phantom Neuro is an Austin-based startup that's trying to provide more lifelike control of prosthetic limbs. So basically what this company is doing is they want to build a thin, flexible muscle implant that they could put, you know, inside a limb, and that would allow amputees to have a wider, more natural range of movement. And also it would have a faster response time. So this would be a lot better than current prosthetics at basically acting more like, you know, a biological limb.
So there are other groups that are trying to do more neurological control directly in the brain, mm-hmm. right? How does this compare to those things?
Yeah. So this would be basically implanted in the muscle. So kind of close to where the amputation is. In theory, it could be less risky than doing a brain implant. You know, messing with the brain is like, what's going on there? And so this could be a little bit, you know, easier and less risky of a surgery and of a process. But also this company hasn't actually done implants yet. They are just announced data testing out kind of a wearable version of their device, which they did show worked pretty well. But the next stage, which they want to do next year, is start to do these implants to see how they really work.
What kind of prosthetics have they made or do they plan to make in terms of parts of the body?
Oh, yeah. So the test that they did was an arm, and they want to do this with kind of upper limb amputees. And so they were able to kind of have people doing, you know, opening and closing their hand, moving their wrist around, stuff like that. So arms is kind of the target for this first test.
Well, great. Well, let's hope that technology advances to where people need it. Let's pivot away from electronics to some climate news. There's been kind of an Arctic climate report card that's come out with some, as you might imagine, some bad news about the tundra, right?
Yes, the news is not great in the Arctic. Based on this data, researchers are able to say kind of for the first time definitively that for the past 20 years, the tundra has been emitting more CO2, carbon dioxide, than it has removed. This is different from what's been happening for the last thousands of years. Usually the Arctic tundra locks away more carbon than it emits. You know, plants grow, they soak up carbon dioxide as they grow, they get buried in the soil, and that kind of gets locked away. And that's a great thing for, you know, climate change, because we want less of that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere warming up our planet. But as temperatures have risen, in part because of, you know, human activities and fossil fuels, temperatures have started to thaw the tundra. So microbes are kind of active, breaking down that stored plant matter. There are wildfires. And so, yeah, we're seeing that the kind of balance has flipped in the Arctic.
Is this report card all bad news, or is there maybe some good news here?
Definitely a lot of bad news, but there are some glimmers of good news, which I always love to look for. So ice seal populations around Alaska that have been challenged by rising temperatures, those populations look to be pretty healthy. There was also a pretty cool winter, which helped Greenland's ice sheet shed the smallest volume of ice in over a decade, which is exciting. But to be clear, you know, it's still melting. It's just melting slower than it has. So good news, but things are definitely serious.
Okay, we'll take it with a grain of salt. Let's shift gears here. We've been hearing a lot recently about bird flu, H5N1. And it's not just in birds, it's in cattle as well. But now there's news about a testing program for milk.
Yes. So this is the first mandatory testing program. The USDA announced it this week. So for about 9 months, we've seen the virus H5N1 spreading through dairy cows. And there have been some states that have started testing for this to really understand where dairy herds are being affected and to what extent. But now we'll have a mandatory testing program starting with just 6 states, but it should expand. And this should hopefully help researchers get a better handle on where this virus is spreading and how.
Do we know what's going to happen when a test comes up positive? At poultry farms, for example, we've heard that there's been a ton of culling of animals. Would that possibly happen here too?
Yeah, it's a really different situation, because when birds are affected, it can be really deadly for them. Cows seem to very rarely die from infection, so I don't know that that's very likely. I think that really the main goal right now is just tracking and understanding. The virus it's possible that it's spreading to humans through cows. We don't really know if infected milk is able to infect humans. But it's possible that if the virus goes through mammals, it could become more dangerous for humans. So just getting a better understanding is, I think, really the key thing here.
Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye out on that news into the new year. But let's shift to some more positive animal news. There's been work towards protecting the monarch butterfly. Tell me about this.
Yes. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is adding monarch butterflies to the threatened species list by the end of next year. It's, you know, kind of bad news, but we've known for a long time that monarch butterflies, we've seen populations going down. And so this status would basically, like you said, help protect the butterfly. It would prohibit people from killing or transporting it. There would be kind of restrictions around what people can do with milkweed, which is an important food source for monarchs. And it would sort of protect some of their key habitat in California.
So would this actually like lock away habitat from development?
because this would list them as a threatened species and not an endangered species, it's not quite as strict. But yeah, those 4,000 acres in coastal California, there would be kind of restrictions and like certain rules around development. So it definitely would affect some people, but it's not quite as strict.
Mm-hmm. A lot of things are potentially going to change with this new political climate that we're entering into. Is this something that might be affected by a new administration?
Yeah, so this announcement opens up a public comment period of about 90 days. And so after that, the agency can kind of lock this in or tweak it or cancel it. So it's not a done deal just yet. And we'll have to watch. The agency has until the end of next year, if they decide to do it, to actually make this final.
Okay. So finally, our last story, we're going to move from butterflies to moths and a story about how they can actually listen to plants, Casey.
Yes. I wish I were a moth because I would love to be able to listen to what my houseplants say to me, like what I'm doing wrong.
I'm thirsty.
Literally. So yes. Researchers have known for a while that some plants, when they're under stress, they make noises. They make ultrasonic clicks. So these aren't something that humans can hear, but some animals can, including some insects. And now researchers found that some moths are able to hear those sounds and interpret them as clues to decide where to lay their eggs. So basically, the researchers put two healthy plants on kind of either end of a room. Both were thriving, both were hydrated. But they played the sounds of a dehydrated, you know, not very happy plant from one of those. And the moths avoided that one. Even though it was totally fine, it sounded like it wasn't. And so they really tended to prefer the healthy plant that wasn't making any distress noises. The idea here is that, you know, the healthy plant will be able to nourish their eggs. It'll provide a good food source. So they're really going for the healthy plants here. They want the best home that they can possibly get. So that's what researchers think is happening with this, their listening skills.
Thank you so much, Casey. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to be here.
Casey Crownhart, climate and technology reporter at MIT Technology Review.